This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Que viva allí. and everybody can play. Yes, you know Jesus is standing at the home plate. He's waiting for you there. Well, you know life is a ball game, but you've got to play it fair.
Good evening. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with myself, Anne-Marie Hendrickson, with Bill Weinberg, engineering, and has some things
kibitzing.
Kibitzing has some, definitely has some things to say. And that was The Ball Game by Sister Winona Ryan. And probably if the Mets had had a lineup like that, perhaps they would not have collapsed in the greatest collapse in major league history.
So
they're saying it's like seven games ahead of the beginning of September and out of the scene entirely by Sunday. Miserable.
What a humiliation for us Queens boys.
What a humiliation for the folks of Queens. And those of us who love the Mets. And it's kind of hard to even have it sink in. How can you have they lost 7 runs in the first half of the first inning. Glavine gave up 7 runs. Like, just one after another. It was like I was saying, at home, I'm just going to be really, really interested to hear. Not anytime soon, but sometime down the line, we're going to be hearing exactly what was going on internally in the Mets as this is going on in September, because I believe that there is some kind of internal squabbling that we're not aware of.
Mm.
That's my feeling. When a team suddenly stops playing like a team like that and people seem visibly out of sorts on the diamond, then I believe that something is going on. I wonder what it is.
Well, I don't know. I think that, both of the teams in this town are losing their souls because they're losing their stadiums.
Oh, well, Mets are even worse. The new Mets stadium is going to be worse than the Yankee stadium. It's going to have, I think, 7,000 less seats than the previous one?
Mm.
It's a really significantly smaller number of seats. And, of course, like all these things, it's, a ye old baseball stadium with an E at the end of it kind of baseball stadium. It's very old-timey.
Oh, yeah, the new one that they're building?
The new one they're building, it's based on Camden Yards, whatever they actually call the stadium in Baltimore. It has some, like, kind of hokey name, like Ye Old Baseball Stadium at Camden Yards.
So it's like self-consciously retro.
It's a self-consciously retro stadium. But unlike an actual old-time baseball park, the reason this has less seats is because it has more boxes. Because whether, the rich, corporate folks that, buy the season tickets show up or not, they buy that stuff years in advance, and of course that's money directly into the pockets of the team no matter what.
It's the same crap which is happening in every sphere of our society, isn't it? I mean, the way they squeeze more and more people into everything other than first class and give first class more and more leg room on airplanes these days.
And the irony
is... And what's happening to the real estate situation in New York, obviously.
What I was saying actually early in the year was that the irony was that they were doing this at a time when they actually had a team that was going to sell more tickets. Because as a longtime backer of the Mets, one of the great things about backing the losing team is it's really easy to get seats. You can even come on the day of the game and get actually very good seats because no one's there. And this season it hasn't been like that. And now with this, I guess it'll be interesting.
It might be like that again.
Might be like that again. We shall see. The only good thing I could say about the Mets' new stadium, which I refuse to call City Field.
Is that what they're calling it?
Well, because Citibank is paying for it.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
The thing is, one of the things that makes it really hard to follow sports these days is that all these stadiums that you thought you knew the name of, now they have some new name and you can't remember what city it's even in when you hear the name of it because you don't know what it is.
Well, there's already a Keyspan Stadium.
Yeah, but
out in Coney Island.
But at least that's kind of new. Well, it's not like there. Leagues. It's not like there was one there before. Right. It's not like it was. You know, like Surf Stadium or something, and now it's Keyspan. I mean, it's actually a new thing, but.
But just the creeping corporatization.
Just the creeping corporatization.
Or galloping, as the case may be.
Right. The only thing I can say about the Mets is at least they're not displacing everybody in the neighborhood. They're building the new stadium in the old part of the old parking lot. So,
right.
Whatever displacement was done, it was done a long time ago, and you know.
Right.
It's over and done. They're not like.
Whereas up at Yankee Stadium.
Oh yeah, they've already like bulldozed through like.
City Park, right?
City Park, yeah. And a whole bunch of, you know, parks and everything else. And I won't even get into the, like, boondoggle that they're building in downtown Brooklyn, you know, supposedly to bring the basketball team in, where they're going to, like, tear down all these houses and all this kind of stuff, the nightmare that is going on with the Nets, Atlantic Yards, the Nets stadium. So.
But we beat him back on the west side,
right?
Finally, the Jets. I mean, sorry.
At least they've, for the moment, that particular like bad idea has not panned out. So, you know, I keep trying to love the Mets, but they make it so difficult. I don't even mind the losing; it's just sort of more the. You know what I really don't like? I don't like that they. I mean, maybe it was just that they were sort of so shamefaced that they couldn't come out and say they were sorry. But even, you know, their email to their fans was
getting a lot of abuse.
Yeah, they didn't come out. I mean, every year they come out at the end of the, at the last game, and they say thank you to the fans. And I would think particularly on a day like that, it would have been a day where that would have been particularly appropriate to come out and say, boy, are we sorry.
Well, maybe they were too dejected. That's the popular wisdom.
I think they probably were too dejected, but that's the moment when you do that, you know, and then people are more likely to
come back next year and
well to forgive you because they feel that you
keep the home fires
that you're
burning.
As sad as they are, whereas otherwise they just
feel betrayed and sit sobbing in the bleachers, as apparently many people did.
Or they feel that like these guys don't care that they want to win because they're going to get paid anyway, which is
exactly
you know. So, which is, you know, it's true, and why shouldn't they in a way? But it's still a bummer. It's a big, major bummer.
Well, it's a bummer for those of you who care about sports. I've got plenty of other things to be depressed about, thank you.
But it's such a pure thing to be depressed about.
That's true. When I was 17, I probably would have been moderately depressed. My brother would have been heartbroken. In fact, he probably is. He stuck with the Mets. I didn't.
Right. It's not even just that it's next year. It's that this year was supposed to be the year. The year, I mean, they were so sure they were going to win that they were actually cocky about it. And then to, like,
right.
just, like,
yes,
fall apart
yes,
so completely
yes, yes,
is, like,
yes.
particularly embarrassing.
Well,
there's no joy in Mudville. I guess we know who the goat is.
Well, in terms of losing your soul to, you know, when you lose your old stadium, it has to be said that Shea Stadium never really had that much soul.
I think a lot of people felt that way because it was like the replacement Ebbets. So for many people, I think that it was always, yeah.
I mean, Yankee Stadium has actually got a certain sense of legacy and romanticism to it. Shea Stadium really doesn't. Despite the fact that the Beatles played there.
Oh, and I was... actually sent an email that the Pope was going to make in his tour of the United States was that he, one of the places, they were giving him a list of places to, that he might give a speech in New York, and he okayed Yankee Stadium, but the Vatican decided they would under no circumstances speak at Shea.
Oh?
And they didn't even really give a reason for it.
Oh, gee, well, thanks a lot. Gee, thanks, El Pape.
I would just...
I'll have to remember to snub you when I go to Rome. Jeez.
I would love to know...
Now I'm glad I didn't go to the Vatican when I was in Rome. He's snubbing my borough? Gee, thanks.
You didn't sack the Vatican when you had the chance? Well.
My former borough, to be entirely accurate, but I'm still a Queens boy at heart, even though I haven't lived there since I was 19.
The borough that spawned you.
Exactly. Anyway, did you identify the opening music?
Yeah, it's off. It's actually off some, what is this, some flashback what is this?
Is it a baseball themed CD?
It's a baseball themed CD. I actually don't know that much about most of the records, most of the songs on this album.
What is it called?
It's called The Ball Game. Just went out of Ryan.
That's the song or the CD?
That's the name of the song. Mm-hmm. The song is called Baseball Hits. It's just a collection of singles that have to do with baseball, and perhaps we'll hear more from it later in the evening.
Yes, and I should mention, by the way, that we opened with Ricardo Aguirre, one of the kings of Gaitero music from Venezuela. And that was his smash hit, La Pica Pica, as performed by Oscar Gonzalez, a fellow Gaitero from the Zulia region on the Venezuelan plains.
Cool.
So, what else we got lined up, Anne-Marie?
Do you have any announcements?
I could read some announcements.
I have one, but I don't have in front of me, if you could look it up, unless you were going to announce it anyway, that there's a Gypsy Film Festival on the Lower East Side.
Really?
If you looked up Gypsy Film Festival in New York City.
I'll do that immediately.
Because our printer isn't working at home, so I didn't have it. It started actually yesterday.
Are they calling it a Gypsy Film Festival as opposed to a Roma Film Festival?
Yes, they are.
Uh-huh. Okay, using the handy internet here. New York Gypsy Film Festival.
Yeah, that's it.
I'll bet that's it, indeed. October 1st through 7th,
that
it's just about, I guess,
It just started yesterday. We missed the beginning, it's going to go on all week.
Right. And it's going to be at a place called Mehanata, 113 Ludlow Street on the Lower East Side. Through literally centuries of slavery, genocide, massacre, and relentless ostracization, the Romani, or Gypsy people, who presently number around 15 million worldwide, continue to suffer unprecedented levels of violence, civilian attacks, and fervent segregation, police brutality, etc. So we've heard, yes. Abrasive, intimately, and artfully handled in 12 hand-picked films from Bulgaria, Serbia, Hungary, Greece, and the U.S., the first annual New York Gypsy Film Festival brings some of these artists and their subjects to the forefront of the so-called First World, with love and without mercy. The festival includes the world premiere of Sandor Nagy's Mundi Romani, the first Roma pavilion in Venice Biennial 2007, with the participation of 12 Roma artists from Hungary. And the American premiere of Ivana Torovic's Everyday Life. So, thanks for the tip. That sounds really interesting. Once again, that's going to be happening this week, every night this week, through the 7th at Mehanata at Ludlow Street, 113 Ludlow Street, which I imagine is the block immediately south of Houston.
Yeah, sounds like.
Sounds good. And let's see. A week from tonight is going to be the Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum. Let me not fail to announce it for a change. Especially since I'm apparently going to
be... Are you a speaker?
Well, I am a speaker.
Oh, okay.
And
always good to remember to announce your own events.
Exactly, which I frequently forget to do. Sarah Ferguson from the Village Voice and... Hanan Reznikov from the Living Theater, and possibly Seth Tobachman from World War III Illustrated, are going to be joining Clayton Patterson, who is the editor of the book Resistance, which is a radical history of the Lower East Side, to which all of the aforementioned are contributors, including myself. So they're all going to be speaking about precisely that, about the radical history of the Lower East Side.
Cool.
That's going to be happening 1 week from tonight, October 9th, at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, also immediately south of Houston Street on the Lower East Side, at 7:30 p.m. So see you there, I hope. 1 week from tonight, October 9th, at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, 7:30 p.m., the Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum on a presentation about the book Resistance on the Radical History of the Lower East Side with the editor Clayton, Patterson, and various contributors, including myself. And let's see, what else is going on this week? I think I've got something else going on this week, don't I? Oh, yeah, this is my other gig, my last chance to announce it. I've been announcing the hell out of it, but I'll announce it again. But I feel like I'm overlooking something. Isn't there something else I'm supposed to announce?
It'll come to you.
Right, it'll come to me when I'm bicycling home, right after I get off the air. That's the way it usually works. But just to remind listeners one more time, this Thursday, October 4th, I am going to be doing a report back from my trip to Japan. Now, I know I already spoke about this on the radio at length, here you'll actually be able to get to ask me questions one-on-one or throw tomatoes at me if you don't like what I'm saying.
Do you have pictures?
No, I don't have pictures, but I did bring back some literature from Japan from the peace groups there and so on, who are resisting the changes to the Constitution, which the ruling Liberal Democratic Party has been trying to push through, which will further allow the remilitarization of the country and so on. They were just dealt unfortunately, the Liberal Democratic Party's most bellicose wing was dealt a defeat in the last elections, and as a result, Shinzo Abe was forced to step down. So this is a good thing. This is some progress. But mostly, I'm going to be talking about the Iraqi Freedom Congress and the civil resistance in Iraq, which a Japanese anti-war group, Zenko, is vigorously organizing solidarity on behalf of. So, this is what I'm going to be talking about. It's going to be brought to you by the National Organization for the Iraqi Freedom Struggles and by the New Space, the New School for Pluralistic Anti-Capitalist Education. It's going to be this Thursday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at 44 East 32nd Street on the 11th floor. That's between Park and Madison. 44 East 32nd Street up on the 11th floor between Park and Madison. And all the information is online at the New Space website. And once again, you can find them most easily by going to our own website, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade's own website, which is morc.info. And just click where it says links, and you'll see the link to the New Space. And just click on that, and all the information will be right in front of your very eyes. So hope to see you once again this Thursday at 7 p.m., October 4th at 44 East 32nd Street between Park and Madison, 11th floor. And those of you who disagree with me can, mix it up, or if you just sort of don't get what I'm saying, maybe I'll have a better chance of making it clear when I'm talking to you one-on-one as opposed to through the medium of radio. So give me a chance, folks, okay? All right, I'm going to have to dig through my email to find the event which I have this eerie feeling that I'm forgetting to announce. So maybe you've got your event lined up at this point?
No, I don't really have an event. The event was thinking of actually was this Gypsy Film Festival. I didn't have the stuff in front of me.
All right. Then forge on ahead.
Oh, well, this is going to be kind of long. Is that okay? Let me...
Unless you want to take a musical break.
We could play another baseball
song. Yeah, why don't
song.
We do that? Why don't we do that?
So when we play the ball game. Let's see. Oh, we should play number 4, Baseball Blues.
Oh, well, that's certainly appropriate. That's certainly appropriate for people who care about this sort of thing. Here, let's hit the Baseball Blues.
Viva la flor de la Habana.
Nope, got my CDs mixed up. Sorry about that, folks. It's called live radio for a reason. No? Wait a minute. We have a mystery. They're both en español. ¿Qué está pasando aquí? All right, okay. This is the Ricardo Aguirre, and this is the Baseball Hits. That was mysterious. Okay, let's try again.
It's a BAI mystery. 1, 2, 3.
It's a BAI mystery. Yes, indeed it is. Okay. This ought to be it. It's thing is faking me out. All right. One more time.
Ah, that's it.
I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. Well, I asked him, honey, hey, what do you want? He said, honey, babe, there's only one thing I want, and that's some baseball shoes. And that's why I've got the baseball blues. I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. Well, I've been to the store 1, 2, 3, 4 times. I said, hey, mister, have you got any more of them baseball shoes? Because my baby's got the baseball blues. I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. I've got the baseball blues because my baby ain't got no baseball shoes. Well, every time I've been to a shop, I say, any baseball shoes, have you got it? My baby's got the baseball blues because my baby got no baseball shoes. I've got the baseball blues because my baby got no baseball shoes. I said that I've got the baseball blues because my baby got no baseball shoes. Instead of the baseballs, will you have me? 'Cause it seems like I'm the only thing that's free. And give up the baseball blues, 'cause you ain't got no baseball shoes.
12:31 in the a.m. here on listener-supported 99.5 WBAI-FM here in New York City. When who was that all-too-appropriate baseball blues song we just heard here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, Anne-Marie?
That's by a singer named Claire Hamill, who is an English singer-songwriter who was active in the early 70s, and I believe still is, but I'm not that familiar with the work she's doing today. Apparently she's doing new age music, so I don't know much about it. But in the early 70s, she was on Island along with Nick Drake and Richard Thompson and was part of that whole extremely fertile, interesting English folk rock scene that was going on at the time. And she had some... She's kind of mentored by Ray Davies of the Kinks, and I think she toured them for a while. I think she toured them at some point. I know that she sang on a couple of their records.
And she's doing new age music today.
I actually saw her...
Stylistic leap.
I saw her, like, in L.A. in the early 70s. Like, she was touring with Pearl Harem, I think. And, like I said, I really didn't know much about her until I decided to play this song tonight, and then I actually looked her up and found out she's been doing all kinds of things I know nothing about in the interim period. So, but that's a pretty song, isn't it? And I believe that all of us who have the baseball blues may want to take her advice and move on to something. We may want to hang on to something else for the knots.
Well, you just
cheer baseball is breaking our hearts. So.
Cheer yourself up with the latest news from Iraq or whatever.
Something like that, yeah.
So you brought some food for our heads.
Right, or perhaps you might want to cheer yourself up by going to the movies. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about Westerns tonight, and I'm going to be reading a story. I planned it this weeks ago, and luckily the movie is still in the theater, so it's not totally out of date.
3:10 to Yuma,
I'm going to
read
the story 3:10 to Yuma by Elmore Leonard. And mostly to sort of give you an example of how a rather simple story can become more complicated in the movies, in both the original 50s version and in the current version. And I'll probably want to talk a little bit about Westerns beyond that. But this is you can read this for yourself in the collected Western stories of Elmore Leonard that came out a couple of years ago. He's available in any bookstore. He's a popular writer. It's in paperback, I believe. But originally was printed in a magazine that literally was called Dime Western Magazine in March of 1953. And Elmore Leonard, in fact, took rather a long time to hit the big time. But one of the differences between old Hollywood, the golden age of Hollywood, and now is that people always complain that they're getting stories from comic books and, you know, reality TV and similar lowbrow places. Well, in the golden age of Hollywood, they got stories from things like Dime Western Magazine. But Elmore Leonard was always a superior writer of Dime Westerns, and I'm going to read this story as an example of why. And it is called 3:10 to Yuma.
All right, so the story which the movie is based on is such
this a... story I'm going to read to you.
Is such a short story that you can read it in the space of 20 minutes or whatever it's going
to be? That's right.
Okay.
It's a very short story. He had picked up his prisoner at Fort Huachuca shortly after midnight, and now, in a silent early morning mist, they approached contention. The two riders moved slowly, one behind the other. Entering Stockman Street, Paul Skellen glanced back at the open country with the wet haze blanketing its flatness, thinking of the long night ride from Huachuca, relieved that this much was over. When his body turned again, his hand moved over the sawed-off shotgun that was across his lap, and he kept his eyes on the man ahead of him until they were near the end of the second block, opposite the side entrance of the Republic Hotel. He said just above a whisper, though it was clear in the silence, "End of the line." The man turned in his saddle, looking at Scallon curiously. "The jail's around on commercial. I want you to be comfortable." Scallon stepped out of the saddle, lifting a Winchester from the boot, and walked toward the hotel's side door. A figure stood in the gloom of the doorway behind the screen, and as Scallon reached the steps near the screen door, opened. "Are you the marshal?" "Yes, sir." Scallon's voice was soft and without emotion. "Deputy from Bisbee." "We're ready for you. 207, a corner. Front's on commercial." He sounded proud of the accommodation. "You're Mr. Timpey?" The man in the doorway looked surprised. "Yeah, Wells Fargo. What did you expect?" "You might have got a back room, Mr. Timpey, one with no windows." He swung the shotgun on the man still mounted. "Step down easy, Jim." The man, who was in his early 20s, a few years younger than Scallon, sat with one hand over the other on the saddle horn. Now he gripped the horn and swung down. When he was on the ground, his hands were still close together, iron manacles holding them three chain lengths apart. Scallon motioned toward the door with the stubby barrel of the shotgun. "Anyone in the lobby?" "The desk clerk," Timpey answered him, "and a man in a chair by the front door." "Who's he?" "I don't know. He's asleep. Got his hat down over his eyes." Did you see anyone out on commercial? No, I haven't been out there. At first he had seemed nervous, but now he was irritated and a frown made his face pout childishly. Scallon said calmly, Mr. Timpey, it was you. It was your line this man robbed. You want to see him go all the way to Yuma, don't you? Certainly I do. His eyes went to the outlaw Joe Kidd. Jim Kidd, sorry. Then back to Scallon hurriedly. But why all the melodrama? The man's under arrest, already been sentenced. But he's not in the jail till he walks through the gates at Yuma, Scallon said. I'm only one man, Timpey, and I've got to get him there. Well, damn it, I'm not the law. Why didn't you bring men with you? All I know is I got a wire from my Bisbee office to get a hotel room and meet you here the morning of November 3rd. There weren't any instructions that I had to get myself deputized and marshal. That's your job. I know it is, Mr. Timpey, Scallon said, and smiled, though it was an effort. But I want to make sure no one knows Jim Kidd's in contention until after train time this afternoon. Jim Kidd had been looking from one to the other with a faintly amused grin. Now he said to Timpey, he means he's afraid someone's going to jump him. He smiled at Scallon. That marshal must have really sold you a bill of goods. What's he talking about? Timpey said. Kidd went on before Scallon could answer. They hid me in the Washoeka lockup because they knew no one could get at me there. And finally, the Bisbee marshal gets a plan. He and some others hopped the train in Benson last night, heading for Yuma with an army prisoner passed off as me. Kidd laughed as if the idea were ridiculous. Is that right? Timpey said. Scallon nodded. Pretty much right. How does he know all about it? He's got ears and 10 fingers to add with. I don't like it. Why just one man? Every deputy from here down to Bisbee is out trying to scare off the rest of them. Jim's here. Jim here's the only one we caught, Scallon explained. Then added, alive. Timpey shot a glance at the outlaw. Is he the one who killed Dick Moons? One of the passengers swears he saw who did it, and he didn't identify Kidd at the trial. Timpey shook his head. Dick drove us for a long time. You know his brother lives out here in contention. When he heard about it, he almost went crazy. He hesitated and then said again, I don't like it. Scallon felt his patience wearing away, but he kept his voice even when he said, Maybe I don't either, but what you like and what I like aren't going to matter a whole lot with a marshal past Tucson by now. You can grumble about it all you want, Mr. Timpey, as long as you keep it under your breath. Jim's got friends, and since I have to haul him clear across the territory, I just assume they didn't know about it. Timpey fidgeted nervously. I don't see why I have to get dragged into this. My job's got nothing to do with law enforcement. You have the room key? In the door. All I'm responsible for is the stage run between here and Tucson. Scallon shoved the Winchester at him. If you'll take care of this and the horses till I get back, I'll be obliged to you. And I know I don't have to ask you not to mention we're in the hotel. He waved the shotgun and nodded, and Jim Kidd went ahead of him through the side door into the hotel lobby. Scallon was astride behind him, holding the stubby shotgun close up to his leg. Up the stairs on the right, Jim. Kidd started up, but Scallon paused to glance at the figure in the armchair near the front. He was sitting on his spine with limp hands folded on his stomach, and as Timpey has described, his hat low over the upper part of his face. You've seen people sleeping in hotel lobbies before, Scallon told himself, and followed Kidd up the stairs. He couldn't stand and wonder about it. Room 207 was narrow and high-ceilinged, with a single window looking down on Commercial Street. An iron bed was placed the long way against one wall and extended to the right side of the window, and along the opposite wall was a dresser with a wash basin and pitcher, and next to it a rough board wardrobe. An unpainted table and two straight chairs took up most of the remaining space. Lay down in the bed if you want to, Scallon said. Why don't you sleep? Kidd asked. I'll hold the shotgun. The deputy moved one of the straight chairs near to the door and the other to the side of the table opposite the bed. Then he sat down, resting the shotgun on the table so that it pointed directly at Jim Kidd, sitting on the edge of the bed near the window. He gazed vacantly outside. A patch of dismal sky showed above the frame buildings across the way, but he was not sitting close enough to look directly down onto the street. He said indifferently, I think it's going to rain. There was a silence, and then Scallon said, Jim, I don't have anything against you personally. This is what I get paid for, but I just want it understood that if you start across the 7 feet between us, I'm going to pull both triggers at once without first asking you to stop. That clear? Kidd looked at the deputy marshal, then his eyes drifted out the window again. It's kind of cold, too. He rubbed his hands together, and the three chain links rattled against each other. The window's open a crack. Can I close it? Scallon's grip tightened on the shotgun, and he brought the barrel up, though he wasn't aware of it. If you can reach it from where you're sitting. Kid looked at the windowsill and said without reaching toward it, "Too far." "All right," Scallon said, rising. "Lay back on the bed." He worked his gun belt around so that now the Colt was on his left hip. Kid went back slowly, smiling. "You don't take any chances, do you? Where's your sporting blood?" "Down in Bismuth with my wife and three youngsters," Scallon told him without smiling and moved around the table. There were no grips on the window frame. Standing with his side to the window, facing the man on the bed, he put the heel of his hand on the bottom ledge of the freight and shoved down hard. The window banged shut, and with a slam he saw Jim Kidd kicking up off of his back, his body straining to rise without his hands to help. Momentarily, Scallon hesitated and his finger tensed on the trigger. Kidd's feet were on the floor, his body swinging up and his head down to lunge from the bed. Scallon took one step and brought his knee up hard against Kidd's face. The outlaw went back across the bed, his head striking the wall. He lay there with his eyes open, looking at Scallon. "Feel better now, Jim?" Kidd brought his hands up to his mouth, working the jaw around. "Well, I had to try you out," he said. "I didn't think you'd shoot." "But you know I will the next time." For a few minutes, Kidd remained motionless. Then he began to pull himself straight. "I just want to sit up." Behind the table, Scallon said, "Help yourself." He watched Kidd stare out the window. Then, "How much do you make, Marshal?" Kidd asked the question abruptly. "I don't think that's any of your business." "What difference does it make?" Scallon hesitated. $150 a month," he said, finally. "Some expenses and a dollar bounty for every arrest against a Bismuth ordinance in the town limits." Kidd shook his head sympathetically. "And you got a wife and three kids." "Well, it's more than a cowhand makes." "But you're not a cowhand." "I've worked my share of beef." "40 a month in keep, huh?" Kidd laughed. "That's right, 40 a month," Scallon said. He felt awkward. "How much do you make?" Kidd grinned. When he smiled, he looked very young, hardly out of his teens. "Name a month," he said. "It varies." "But you've made a lot of money." "Enough. I can buy what I want." "What are you going to be wanting the next 5 years? "You're pretty sure we're going to Yuma." "And you're pretty sure we're not," Scallon said. "Well, I've got 2 train passes and a shotgun that says we are. What do you got?" Kidd smiled. "You'll see." Then he said right after it, his tone changing, "What made you join the law?" "The money," Scallon answered, and then felt foolish as he said it. But he went on. "I was working for a spread over by the Patana Wash when old Nana broke loose and raised hell up the Santa Rosa Valley. The army was going around in circles, so the Pima County Marshal got up a bunch to help out, and we tracked Apaches almost all spring. The Marshal and I got along fine, so he offered me a deputy job if I wanted it. He wanted to say that he started out for 75 and worked up to the 150, but he didn't. And then, someday, you'll get to be Marshal and make 200. Maybe. And then one night a drunk hound you'll never see will be tearing up somebody's saloon and you'll go in to arrest him, and he'll drill you with a lucky shot before you get your gun out. So, you're telling me I'm crazy, if you don't already know it." Scallon took his hand off the shotgun and pulled tobacco and paper from his shirt pocket and began rolling a cigarette. "Have you figured out what my price is yet?" Kidd looked startled momentarily, but the grin returned. "No, I haven't. Maybe you come higher than I thought." Scallon scratched a match across the table, lighted the cigarette, then threw it to the floor between Kidd's boots. "You don't have enough money, Jim." Kidd shrugged and then reached down for the cigarette. "You treated me pretty good. I just wanted to make it easy on you." The sun came into the room after a while, weakly at first, cold and lazy. And then it warmed and brightened and cast an oblong patch of light between the bed and the table. The morning wore on slowly because there was nothing to do when each man sat restlessly thinking about somewhere else, even though it was a restlessness within and it showed on neither of them. The deputy rolled cigarettes for the outlaw and himself, and most of the time they smoked in silence. Once Kidd asked him what time the train left. He told him shortly after 3, but Kidd made no comment. Scallon went to the window and looked out the narrow rutted road that was Commercial Street. He pulled out a watch from his vest pocket and he looked at it. It was almost noon, yet there were few people about. He wondered about this and asked if it was unnaturally quiet for a Saturday noon in contention, or if it were just his nerves. He studied the man standing under the wooden awning against the street, leaning idly against a support post with his thumbs hooked in his belt and his flat-crowned hat on the back of his head. There was something familiar about him, and each time Scallon had gone to the window, a few times during the past hour, the man had been there. He glanced at Jim Kidd lying across the bed and looked out over the window in time to see another man moving up next to the one at the post. They stood together for the space of a minute before the second man turned a horse from the rail, swung up, and rode out down the street. The man at the post watched him go and tilted his hat across the sun, against the sun's glare. And then it registered. With the hat low on his forehead, Scanlon saw him again as he had that morning. That man lying in the armchair, as if asleep. He saw his wife then and his three youngsters, and he could almost feel the little girl sitting in his lap where she had climbed up to kiss him goodbye, and he had promised to bring her something from Tucson. He didn't know why they had come to him all of a sudden, and after he had put them out of his mind, since there was no room now, there was an upset feeling inside as if he had swallowed something that would not go down all the way, and it made his heart beat a little faster. Jim Kidd was smiling up at him. "Anybody I know?" "I didn't think it showed. Like the sun going down." Scanlon glanced at the man across the street and then to Jim Kidd. "Come here." He nodded to the window. "Tell me who your friend is over there." Kidd half rose and leaned over, leaning at the window, and then sat down again. "Charlie Prince." "Somebody else just went for help." "Oh, Charlie doesn't need help." "How did you know you were going to be in contention?" "You told that Wells Fargo man I had friends? And about the posses chasing around in the hills? Figure it out for yourself. You could be looking out a window in Benson and you'd be seeing the same thing." "They're not going to do you any good." "I don't know any man who'd get himself killed for $150. Kidd paused. "Especially a man with a wife and young ones." Men rode into town in something less than an hour later. Scanlon heard the horses coming up Commercial and went to the window to see the six riders pull to a stop and range themselves in a line in the middle of the street facing the hotel. Charlie Prince stood behind them, leaning against the post. Then he moved away from it leisurely and stepped down into the street. He walked between the horses and stepped in front of them, just below the window. He cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted, "Jim!" In the quiet street, it was like a pistol shot. Scanlon looked at Kidd, seeing the smile that softened his face and was even in his eyes. Confidence. It was all over him. And even with the manacles on, you would believe that it was Jim Kidd who was holding the shotgun. "What do you want me to tell him?" Kidd said. "Tell him you'll write every day." Kidd laughed and went to the window, pushing it up at the top of the frame. It raised a few inches. Then he moved his hands under the window and it slid up all the way. "Charlie, you go buy the boys a drink. We'll be down shortly." "Are you all right?" "Sure, I'm all right." Charlie Prince hesitated. "What if you don't come down? He could kill you and say you tried to break." "Jim, you tell him what'll happen if we hear a gun go off." "He knows," Kidd said and closed the window. He looked at Scanlon, standing motionless with a shotgun under his arm. "Your turn, Marshal." "What do you expect me to say?" "Something that makes sense. You said before I didn't mean a thing to you personally, that what you're doing is just a job. Well, you figure out if it's worth getting killed for. All you have to do is throw your gun on the bed and let me walk out the door and you can go back to Bisbee and arrest all the drunks you want. Nobody's going to blame you if the odds stack 7-1. You know your wife's not going to complain." "You should have been a lawyer, Jim." The smile began to fade from Kidd's face. "Come on, what's it going to be?" The door rattled with three knocks in quick succession. Abruptly, the room was silent. The two men looked at each other, and now the smile disappeared from Kidd's face completely. Scanlon moved to the side of the door, tiptoeing in his high-heeled boots, and then pointed his shotgun toward the bed. Kidd sat down. "Who is it?" For a moment, there was no answer. Then he heard, "Timpy." He glanced at Kidd, who was watching him. "What do you want?" "I've got a pot of coffee for you." Scanlon hesitated. "You alone?" "Of course I am." "Hurry up, it's hot." He drew the key from his coat pocket, then held the shotgun in the crook of his arm as he inserted the key with one hand and turned the knob with the other. The door opened and slammed against him, knocking him back against the dresser. He went off balance, sliding into the wardrobe, going down on his hands and knees, and the shotgun clattered against the floor to the window. He saw Jim Kidd drop to the floor for the gun. "Hold it!" A heavy-set man stood in the doorway with a Colt pointing out past the thick bulge of his stomach. "Leave that shotgun where it is." Timpy stood next to him with a coffee pot in his hand. There was coffee down the front of his suit, on the door, and on the flooring. He brushed at the front of his coat feebly, looking from Scanlon at the man with the pistol. "I couldn't help it, Marshal. He made me do it. He threatened to do something to me if I didn't." "Who's he?" "Bob Moons. You know, Dick's brother." The heavyset man glanced at Timpy angrily. "Shut your damn whining." His eyes went to Jim Kidd and held there. "You know who I am, don't you?" Kidd looked uninterested. "You don't resemble anybody I know." You didn't have to know Dick to shoot him. I didn't shoot that messenger. Scallon got to his feet, looking at Tiffy. What the hell's wrong with you? I couldn't help it. He forced me. How did he know we were here? He came in this morning talking about Dick, and I felt he needed some cheering up, so I told him Jim Kidd had been tried and was being taken to Yuma and was here in town on his way. Bob didn't say anything and went out, and a little later he came back with a gun. You damn fool. Scallon shook his head wearily. Never mind all the talk. Moons kept the pistol on Kidd. I would have found him sooner or later. This way everybody gets saved a long train ride. You pull that trigger, Scallon said, and you'll hang for murder. Like he did for killing Dick. A jury said he didn't do it. Scallon took a step toward the big man. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let you pass another sentence. You stay put or I'll pass sentence on you. Scallon moved a slow step nearer. Hand me the gun, Bob. I'm warning you, get the hell out of the way and let me do what I came for. Bob, hand me the gun or I swear I'll beat you through that wall. Scallon tensed to take another step, another slow one. He saw Moon's eyes dart from him to Kidd, and in that instant he knew it would be his only chance. He lunged, swinging his coat aside with his hand, and when the hand came up, he was holding the Colt, all in one motion. The pistol went up and chopped an arc across Moon's head before the big man could bring his own gun around. His hat flew off as the barrel swiped his skull, and he went back against the wall heavily and then sank to the floor. Scallon wheeled to face the window, thumbing the hammer back. But Kidd was still sitting on the edge of the bed with the shotgun at his feet. The deputy relaxed, letting the hammer ease down. You might have made it that time. Kidd shook his head. I wouldn't have got off the bed. There was a note of surprise in his voice. You know, you're pretty good. At 2:15, Scallon looked at his watch, then stood up, pushing the chair back. The shotgun was under his arm. In less than an hour, they would leave the hotel, walk over Commercial to Stockman, and then up Stockman to the station. 3 blocks. He wanted to go all the way. He wanted to get Jim Kidd on that train, but he was afraid. He was afraid of what they might do once they were out on the street. Even now his breath was short, and occasionally he would inhale and let the air out slowly to calm himself, and he kept asking himself if it was worth it. People would be in the windows and the doors, though you wouldn't see them. They'd have their own feelings, and most of their hearts would be pounding, and they'd edge back of the door frames a little more. The man out on the street was something without a human nature or personality of its own. He was on a stage. The street was another world. Timpy sat on the chair in front of the door, and next to him, squatting on the floor with his back against the wall, was Moons. Scallon had unloaded Moons' pistol and placed it in the pitcher behind him. Kidd was on the bed. Most of the time he stared at Scallon. His face bore a puzzled expression, making his eyes frown, and sometimes he would cock his head as if studying the deputy from a different angle. Scallon stepped up to the window now. Charlie Prince and another man were under the awning. The others were not in sight. You haven't changed your mind? Kidd asked him seriously. Scallon shook his head. I don't understand you. You risked your neck to save my life, and now you'll risk it again to send me to prison. Scallon looked at Kidd and suddenly felt closer to him than any man he knew. Don't ask me, Jim, he said, and sat down again. After that, he looked at his watch every few minutes. At 3:05, he walked to the door, motioning Timpy aside, and turned the key in the lock. Let's go, Jim. When Kidd was next to him, he prodded Moons with a gun barrel. Over on the bed, mister. If I see or hear about you on the street before train time, you'll face an attempted murder charge. He motioned Kidd past him, then stepped into the hall and locked the door. They went down the stairs and crossed the lobby to the front door, Scallon astride behind with a shotgun barrel almost touching Kidd's back. Passing through the doorway, he said as calmly as he could, turn left on Stockman and keep walking. No matter what you hear, keep walking. As they stepped out onto Commercial, Scallon glanced at the Ramada where Charlie Prince had been standing, but now the saloon porch was an empty shadow. Near the corner, two horses stood under a sign that said EAT in red letters, and on the other side of Stockman, the signs continued, lining the rutted main streets to make it seem narrower, and beneath the signs, in the shadows, nothing moved. There was a whisper of wind along the Ramadas. It whipped sand specks from the street and rattled them against clapboard, and the sound was hollow and lifeless. Somewhere a screen door banged far away. They passed the cafe, turning onto Stockman. Ahead, the deserted street narrowed with distance to a dead end as the rail station, a single-story building standing by itself, low and sprawling, with most of the platform in shadow. The westbound was there along the platform, but the engine and most of the cars were hidden by the station house. White steam lifted above the roof to be lost in the sun's glare. They were almost to the platform when Kidd said over his shoulder, "Run like hell while you're still able." "Where are they?" Kidd grinned because he knew Scallon was afraid. "How should I know?" "Tell them to come out in the open." Tell them yourself. Damn it, tell them. Scallon clenched his jaw and jabbed the short barrel into Kid's back. I'm not fooling. If they don't come back, if they don't come out, I'll kill you. Kid felt the gun barrel hard against his spine, and suddenly he shouted, Charlie! It echoed in the street, but after there was only the silence. Kid's eyes darted over the shadowed porches. Damn it, Charlie, hold on! Scallon prodded him up the warped plank steps to the shade of the platform, and suddenly he could feel them nearer. Tell him again! Don't shoot, Charlie! Kid screamed the words. Then on the other side of the station, they heard the train man's call trailing off. Gila Bend! Sentinel! Yuma! The whistle sounded loud, wailing as they passed into the shade of the platform, then out again to the naked glare of the open side. Scallon squinted, glancing toward the station office, but the train dispatcher was not in sight, nor was anyone. It's the mail car, he said to Kid. The second to last one. Steam hissed from the iron cylinder of the engine, clouding that end of the platform. Hurry it up, he snapped, pushing Kid along. Then from behind, hurried footsteps sounded on the planking, and as the hiss of steam died away, stand where you are! The locomotive's main rod strained back, rising like the legs of a grotesque grasshopper, and the wheels moved. The connecting rod stepped on an upward spring, and couplings clanged on the line of cars. Throw the gun away, brother! Charlie Prince stood at the corner of the station house with a pistol in each hand. Then he moved to run carefully between the two men and the train. Throw it far away and unhitch your belt, he said. Do what he says, Kit said. They've got you. The other, six of them, were strung out in the dimness of the platform shed. Grim face, stubbles of beard, hat brims low. The man nearest Prince spat tobacco hazily. Scallon knew fear at that moment as fear had never gripped him before, but he kept the shotgun hard against Kid's spine. He said, just above a whisper, Jim, I'll cut you in half. Kid's body was stiff, his shoulders drawn up tightly. Wait a minute, he said. He held his palms out to Charlie Prince, though he could have been speaking to Scallon. Suddenly Prince shouted, go down! There was a fraction of a moment of dead silence that seemed longer. Kid hesitated. Scallon was looking at the gunman over Kid's shoulder, seeing the two pistols. Then Kid was gone, rolling on the planking, and the pistols were coming up one ahead of the other. Without moving, Scallon squeezed both triggers of the scattergun. Charlie Prince was going down, holding his hands tight to his chest as Scallon dropped the shotgun and swung around drawing his Colt. He fired hurriedly. Wait for a target, words in his mind. He saw the men under the platform shed, three of them breaking for the station office, two going full length through the planks. One crouched, his pistol up. That one! Get him quick! Scallon aimed and squeezed the heavy revolver, and the man went down. Now get the hell out! Charlie Prince was face down. Kid was crawling frantically and coming to his feet when Scallon reached him. He grabbed Kid by the collar savagely, pushing him on, and dug the pistol into his back. Run, damn you! Gunfire erupted from the shed and thudded into the wooden caboose as they ran past it. The train was moving slowly. Just in front of them, a bullet smashed a window of the mail car. Someone screamed, "You'll hit Jim!" There was another shot, and then it was too late. Scallon and Kid leapt up onto the car platform and were in the mail car as it tumbled past the end of the station platform. Kid was on the floor, stretched out along a row of mail sacks. He rubbed his shoulder awkwardly with his manacled hands and watched Scallon, who stood against the wall next to the open door. Kid studied the deputy for some minutes. Finally, he said, "You know, you really earn your 100 and a half. Scallon heard him, though the iron rhythm of the train wheels and his breathing were loud in his temples. He felt as if all his strength had been sapped, but he couldn't help smile at Jim Kidd. He was thinking pretty much the same thing. And that is the end of the story, and it is exactly 1 o'clock here on the Moorish Orthodox Ready Crusade on WBI New York 99.5, listener-sponsored radio. Now, you get the pulpiness of this story with its violence and also the simplicity of the story. This has been made into a movie twice, once in 1957 and once recently this year, where it's getting spectacular reviews and seen as one of the things that's sort of like bringing back the Western in some kind of big way. And Elmer Leonard's comment on this story, which kind of like helped him hit the big time, certainly helped him hit the big money because once it was picked up by the movies, was it just goes to show you that Hollywood can really screw up a really simple story. Because both versions of this story, of course, have to kind of... This almost seems on the face of it. I mean, when you hear this, you could see that this would have made like a good half-hour television you know, story. You could see this being on something like Have Gun Will Travel or something. It really, you know, and it's very visual. This is, as is common with this kind of writing, which is exactly why this stuff was picked up for the movies. But the thing that's sort of interesting about it that actually is different from other kinds of dime Western fiction, it's sort of the thing that made his reputation, made Elmore Leonard's reputation, is that even in this, and even with sort of the crudeness of the writing, which did improve over the years, everything in this story, and it's a simple story with a simple plot, turns on who these people are. And he establishes who these people are in a very concise and economic kind of way. And although it's sort of a surprising ending, it doesn't seem unbelievable given the what he has told you about them. And all his stories are based on that. And all both of the movie versions of the story retain it also, except they sort of build it up a little more. And it's also not surprising, really, that based on this, that he was able to go on to write crime fiction. And the crime fiction very much sort of follows the this kind of approach that he takes in the Westerns. In fact, one of his stories, I believe, is actually called, I think it's called, I don't remember the name of the book, but the subtitle is High Noon in Detroit, meaning that it's based on this same idea that the good guy and the bad guy have more in common than everyone else in the town because they have some kind of sense of that their own sense of honor will not allow them to back down from the position, whatever that might be. And in the movie version, what we hear, in both movie versions, the wife and the kids that are, you know, off stage on the in the story are very much in the movie, so that the guy, the lawman, has more of a motivation. And in the current version, it's really, really like they kind of hit you over the head with it, and it's almost like Shane, in that the son of the guy really thinks his dad is kind of a loser, and he's missing a leg. He was injured in the war, and he's having a real hard time taking care of his family, and he isn't a deputy. In fact, he's just a rancher who accepts a bounty to bring this guy in for justice. But yet, they still end up having in this hotel room, you know, the kind of face-off that we hear in this story. And not to have a spoiler, because it would be a spoiler for it to tell you, but the ending of the movie, I think, is really untrue to the story in the sense that the bad guy deals with his own hench people in a way that was completely unbelievable to me. It's a quite a spectacular, violent ending, and it's very, very hard to believe.
That's what contrary to all the great reviews it's been getting, somebody I know who saw it said that the ending was very implausible.
The ending is very, very implausible. And up to that point, it really is quite good. So it's disappointing. Mm-hmm. I had avoided, I have at this point actually seen the original version of it in the 50s version. The reason I hadn't seen it was for rather an odd reason, which is that it starred Van Heflin and Glenn Ford, and I just don't like Glenn Ford as an actor. You know, I don't have no real reason for that.
So was the 1956, was that version truer to the book, to the story, I should say?
It didn't have the new ending. Mm-hmm. It had an ending closer to this one. Mm-hmm. It got across the same idea of some sort of like some only semi-spoken understanding between the two men that leads to the ending.
Which movie did you like better?
Up until the ending, I kind of like the new one because I like the actors better. Like I said, I don't really have any good reason for not liking Glenn Ford, but I don't. Mm-hmm. And I probably would have seen it earlier if I just was not avoiding it on purpose, because every time I saw it, I thought, oh, no, I'm not going to. And also, Van Heflin is playing and he's a fine actor, but he's playing the lawman. And it seemed too much like the part he played in Shane, which is not a favorite movie of mine either. And so that. But once I actually saw it all the way through, I could see why people admired it as much as they did and why they liked it. I'm not sure if, well, I'll talk about it a little. I guess there's always room to, like, talk more about it. But I read this to sort of give an example of a certain kind of, like, pulp Western fiction that in a way I think has sort of gone It's gone out of fashion and so thoroughly that, I mean, you couldn't even make a dime Western magazine today, I don't think. Anyway, not for an English-speaking
audience. I was amazed that they actually made this movie. I mean, how long has it been since they made a straight Western?
Well, they bring them back. They do make Westerns, but they certainly are not what they once were. And
what's the last time Hollywood just made a straight Western? I thought there was going to have to be some kind of gimmick to it.
Gimmick? Well, no. I mean, Open Range is a Western. I mean, Unforgiven was a Western. I guess there were others, too. And this one, there's the one coming out actually next weekend, I guess, the Billy the Kid movie.
They made another Billy the Kid movie?
Yeah, it's based on a novel by Ron Hansen.
Yeah?
It's called the Execution of Billy the Kid by the Coward.
Oh, no, you mean Jesse James.
Jesse James, I'm sorry. Right, Jesse James mm-hmm. or the Coward.
Right,
did I say Billy the Kid? Because I'm a moron.
Is that a movie or a TV movie?
It's a movie with a big movie cast. Brad Pitt is in it. That's a movie.
And, you know, I'm probably not going to see that one for the same reason you never saw the original 3 Tenths of Yuma, because I can't stand Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I mean, again, you don't really have to justify that or anything. I don't feel the same, but I could see why one would. And hating an actor is a perfectly valid reason for staying out of the
movie. And he's a very negative historical figure, and I hate to see him being valorized.
Who, Brad Pitt?
Jesse James. I mean, you know, because Billy the Kid actually was, I mean, you know, Billy the Kid was just this messed up kid who was trigger happy, but he was kind of on the side of the good guys in the whole Lincoln County War. Where, you know, he was on the side of the little people who were standing up to the land barons.
But Jesse James.
Jesse James was kind of like a, you know, a Confederacy nostalgist.
Right.
And
Yes. Yep. Yeah, he was involved in, like, the bad side of the Kansas-Missouri
Wars.
That's
exactly right, yeah.
Right, so, yeah, I know. Well, I'll be curious to see what it is anyway, because the book is not sympathetic to Jesse James. I don't know what the movie is, but I bet that's going to be the take that they would have on it, because that would be the take that would be on it.
Well, they're calling his assassin a coward, although
that's sort of
the folklore.
The folklore. Yeah.
The assassin was one of his former henchmen.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway.
Day before yesterday was the 100th anniversary of Gene Autry's birth.
Oh, okay.
And this whole weekend has been on encore. And there's been less this whole year. It's been just a glorious celebration of Gene Autry. I know this is sort of coming out of nowhere, but... And I really... Well, there's always room to come back and talk more about Gene Autry, certainly. Gene Autry has been one of my big discoveries of the last couple of years. But in general, Westerns have. And... I got sort of curious about them a couple of years ago. There were a few things that sort of put a seed of thought in my mind that sort of sat there germinating. And one was that there's a video distribution company called Sinister Cinema, and as their name would tend to suggest, they mostly specialize in horror movies, you know, from, you know, old horror movies from the silent era, early sound era, you know, exploitation movies, science fiction. Noir, crime, all this kind of stuff, but they also distributed a lot of Western movies. And in their catalog, they always had this sort of like plaintive plea, you know, to people saying some of the most interesting movies that we have, that we distribute, are the Westerns, and yet we can't give them away. You know, people that will like, you know, buy any crappy noir thing, you know, even the kind of bad ones or like awful horror movies. And we're telling you, these like B-Westerns are amazing. You know, if you would just see them, you would understand, you know, why they're so great and why you would get into them. And, you know, I would sort of like read it and think, maybe I should, but not enough to buy them, mind you.
This is exactly why I'm surprised that all of a sudden Hollywood has come out with two Westerns. I mean, has there been a season in recent memory when Hollywood produced even one Western?
Not really. And the other thing that put it in my mind, and, it's late, so I'm going to say this now, but I'm definitely going to be talking about this book again. It's that I read a really interesting book a couple of years ago called Radical Hollywood by Paul Bewley and Dave Wagner. And it sort of set out to answer the question that many of us have who are familiar with the story of the Hollywood 10 and with the blacklisting, which is that when you see these old Hollywood movies, kind of hard to see the left-wing influence in them. Hard to see why anybody would go after the screenwriters. You know, they just don't seem that left-wing. I mean, you can pick out a few things here and there, but basically, where's the communism? You know, where is all this, like, dangerous leftism? And so this book gives some answers to that. One of the answers is they're not in the A movies. They were those people working mostly in B movies. And I think historically leftists have felt that if when you look at Hollywood movies, that a lot of people I think do think that B movies are more interesting than A movies because of that, because that they don't have the pressure, because there was less risk, and so you were allowed to get away with things because there wasn't a lot of money involved. And it's felt that certain genres are more intrinsically interesting to leftists than others, like horror movies, because something like Dracula. I mean, it's not even a metaphor. You know, the Count is preying on the people by sucking their blood. You know, that's not even a metaphor. It's just more like a direct social commentary. You know, or the idea that people who are shoved outside of normal, you know, like regular society because they're not normal and they're seen as monsters, as in freaks, you know. You have the genre of crime where, you know, the crime film always has the potential for being very left-wing because you see that street crime is committed by poor people who, you know, even if they do have other options, may feel that they do not. And you see the reasons why people make bad decisions. You see that the people that are most impacted by street crime are poorer people rather than rich people. And the crime that is most organized are the people that are so organized that they're actually running the government and the cops and the church and everything else. And that's true in, like, the Warner crime dramas. It's true in the noir films. I mean, it's not just The Godfather where you see this kind of analysis. It's...
Well, yeah, but just to take a contrary position here, I mean, the bad guys were sort of glorified in the Godfather movies.
Because they're seen as simply the less organized forms of crime. You know, that they're bad, but it's only because the really organized criminals are really run everything, you know.
And certainly, I mean, you know, the whole, past two generations of television cop shows have been pretty right-wing.
But they weren't earlier. I mean, in these old 30s movies, like, they don't even have... The cops are kind of... They may be kind of nice, but they're kind of useless, just like in Sherlock Holmes. And really, the reporters are like the cops in these old movies. The reporter is always going out solving the crime. You haven't noticed that in the 30s and the 40s, they always are.
Or the private dick.
Or the private detective. It's either a private investigator or a reporter. A reporter for a newspaper. And these are seen as more left-wing, but... What they suggest in this book, Radical Hollywood, is that if you look at the B Westerns, the Westerns are usually have a rather left slant as well. And this was a take on Westerns that I had frankly never occurred to me. Because I, like most people, I believe my thought on Westerns was that they were, I like the horses, I like the scenery, but basically it's kind of a right-wing genre. And but it sort of put the idea in my mind that maybe I should check it out. You know, maybe there was something to this. And in fact, a lot of people who were actual leftists wrote these movies. And they directed these movies and were involved in these movies. And the other thing that is interesting about the B Westerns is this is where all the female screenwriters went. One of the things that distinguishes silent movies from sound movies is that in silent movies there was a lot more participation by women behind the camera. There were more female directors, there were more female screenwriters, there were more female producers. And as in the sound era, that all changed pretty abruptly. But a lot, the B Westerns, they're like, I would say 40% of the ones I've seen, and I've seen hundreds at this point, are written or co-written by women. So that in itself is just interesting. And the Gene Autry movies, which is what sort of brought this on, have been showing for the last couple of years on the Encore Western Channel if you have cable. And if you don't, try to find a friend who does. You might want to. And they're all available on DVD, but they're sort of expensive. If you have Netflix, you could rent them. They're all, like, increasingly all that stuff is out. Unlike a lot of people, he was able to get copyright control over his own productions. It took him a long time to get it, but it's actually his estate that owns his stuff, which makes him unusual. And some people worked on B Westerns. Him and Roy Rogers, they both did. And when I started watching them, I mean, they're rather odd. You know, I mean, they don't really take place in the past. For one thing, it's not quite clear what year they are. You know, for one thing, he's often shown as a radio star who has to go do his radio show. But yet he's riding a horse and dressed up like a cowboy and lives in an old-fashioned ranch house and he's going to some little town. But when he needs to get somewhere, he goes in the Buick and puts the horses back in the horse wagon, and then they go drive on to the next town. And, you know, they've people flying planes. It's really, like I said, it's very much, and they're singing.
Gene Autry movies, yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, they're singing, you know. And so it has this sort of, like, weird, stylized, sophisticated world that only a musical can have,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And the first thing I notice is he's basically a very staunch kind of New Deal Roosevelt Democrat. And there have been several books about him that came out this year. The best of which is called Public Cowboy Number One, I am told. I have the book and I've skimmed through it, but I haven't actually read it yet, so I'm not reviewing it. I'm just mentioning that this is the case. And what I did get from just skimming through it is apparently he was, in fact, a staunch New Deal Roosevelt Democrat through his whole life, right down to the end. And, you know, very different from John Wayne, who you think of as sort of the more typical Hollywood cowboy. And for much of his career, he was the most popular Western star in Hollywood. And the people who actually saw cowboy movies were more likely to see one of his movies than one of John Wayne's movies. And he's also never fighting Indians. Like, I would say, like, in one of the ones that I've seen, and it's sort of, even then they're not really the enemy, it's more that there's some kind of, you know, racial, quote, comedy, unquote, around the Indians who live in the town. And I don't remember the name of the movie. I'll look it up when I go home. It's not a whole lot better. It's one that he didn't like and complained about, and it's an anomaly in his oeuvre and not considered a good one by his fans. But in general, he's always fighting the banker. He's fighting the big rancher. He's fighting the guy that's trying to shut out all the farmers.
All those Billy the Kid movies are, you know, pretty true to the actual facts of Billy the Kid, and they are always fighting, you know, the big land barons of the Santa Fe Ring and standing up for the little guys, because that's actually what Billy the Kid did.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm saying, but this isn't purporting to be a historical anything.
Right.
It's just
it's just
the Western cowboy
hero
who goes out fighting the bad guy. But the bad guy is not.
But
the
there's a reason that Billy the Kid became such a legend, which is tied in with that whole, you know, underdog thing.
Right. I'm saying that the whole politics of these movies is similar to the Zorro movies.
Mm-hmm.
That in
right.
general, all these Westerns at this time period were way more to the left than I thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's one of the reasons they were so popular. You know, I think I'm always making these discoveries that, you know, the American past is not, the American public of the past is not as right-wing as sometimes we're led to believe. That I believe it wouldn't have been as popular if he had any other politics. You know, in fact, and they're, you know, they're for children. You know, I mean, they're kind of like Elvis movies or maybe like Bollywood movies or something. There's a lot of songs. There's a pretty strong-willed girl, and they have a kind of a, you know, Beatrice and Benedict kind of like fight going through before they get together at the end. You know, she's usually, and she's not just like the wife or somebody's daughter. She usually runs a newspaper or owns the ranch and is a strong-willed independent woman, as was common in 30s movies. And you have the comic relief, you have the little kid, you have the animals, and you have a couple of really big drawn-out, drag-out fights. You have a big chase. You'll often have something. There'll often be a plot line that involves Gene having to get into a big horse race and, like, you know, so that will take up much of the movie, though, or a car race or something like that. There's a lot of action. There's just something for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
And as there would be in any family-oriented kind of film today, but I guess I really feel like I have to stress, because it was such an eye-opener to me, that these are, you know, left liberal movies, you know. They're not right-wing. I always thought of Westerns as a fairly right-wing genre, and they're not.
But his heyday was considerably before John Wayne's.
They worked kind of out of the same studio. I mean, they both came out of Republic. And Wayne's stuff actually, I mean, it's not like he wrote his movies or anything. Wayne's early stuff is like that also, you know. I think when Gene Autry went into the army, in a way, John Wayne sort of, that's when he became mm-hmm. a more favorite star of Republic. And of course, Wayne, the big jingo, never even fought in the war, mm-hmm. you know, as always is
right,
the case
exactly.
with this. You know, the guy that
like
is.
Reagan.
Right. All the people that are the big flag wavers are the people that didn't actually
right,
do
yes.
anything. But.
Right, but I think the genre moved to the right in the 50s. I mean,
that's my impression also. And also, I think the A movies as a group are way more they're way more likely to show, like, the settlers against the Indians and stuff like that. Those are, like, and I had never quite grasped that, I guess, because... And then the ones that came later, the spaghetti westerns, I wouldn't call them right wing. They're more like kind of, but they're kind of neo, the spaghetti westerns,
oh, yes.
the Italian
mm-hmm.
things. They're not, I mean, they're not right wing, but they're very nihilistic. You know, they're sort of like the guy, they're kind of like this story. They're kind of like the guy with the job against all the losers in the town. You know, they're like samurai movies or something, or Yakuza movies. And, but the thing that is really charming about the Gene Autry movies, it really assumes a community, and assumes a community of people who are all pulling together and trying to make a better life for themselves, and that, that that's a possibility, and that people can do that. And that, that in a way really sets them in the 30s, you know? If only we all really believe that today,
yeah.
you know?
Although, I mean, did you see The Magnificent Seven? You've seen that, of course.
Right.
I mean, that's very much what that's about.
Well, except that it kind of isn't, because all the people in the town are like cowards, and they have to get the seven to do it for them. You know. Like,
yeah, except that they redeem themselves at the end.
Right at the end, they redeem themselves.
And that was in the '50s. That was what?
Right. Well, it's a remake of a Japanese movie.
Right. That's right. Yeah, Seven Samurai. Yeah.
Right.
Which was Kurosawa, right?
Yeah. I think so. When is Magnificent? I think is it '50s? If it's or very it's '60s. I think it was '60s movie. I guess it's very late '50s or very early '60s.
Right.
Of course, this is what we need the Internet Movie Database to tell us.
Well, while you're talking, I'll look it up. How does that sound? Magnificent. Seven.
But it's really been one of my, you know, you live and learn.
I've been 1960.
1960. So, yeah, there you go. Made in the 50s and released in the 60s. So it's, I think in a way these more adult Westerns are the things that killed the genre. I think if they kept making these Gene Autry movies, people would be into them today. I just think, just see, everything about it is more charming and more accessible to me than these other things. They're not, they may be unrealistic, but they're not depressing, you know? And they're not, like I said, they're very positive about human endeavor and about human community. You know, I just, and it became, once I had seen a couple of them, it was instantly obvious to me why he was such a big star at the time and why they were filling theaters with this stuff.
So, do you recommend 310 to Yuma to our audience?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, check it out. It's no Gene Autry, mind you, but the performances are great. I mean, no, I think... You know, no, Russell Crowe and Christian Bale are so much better than the original actors. I mean, it's kind of funny. I wish that they had been cast in the original movie. If you could somehow, like, put them in the TARDIS and take them back through time and cast them in the 1957 movie, I think that would be the perfect solution. Because I like the plotting and the direction of the earlier movie better, but I don't like the casting.
And
so I've seen Peter Fonda play bad guy, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
So I hesitate to ask this, but what about the Billy Jack movies? Is that stretching the definition of the genre too much?
I love the Billy Jack movies, but, you know, I haven't seen them in so long. It's hard to say. I mean, I always – and they're also, as Joe Bob Briggs pointed out many years ago, they're really – as exploitation movies go, they're very girly, you know. They're considered – they're so earnest.
Right.
Wow, it's
yes.
like they're like the most earnest movies that have ever been made. And
that's very true.
And I would love to see
but
them
lots,
again. They came
lots
out
of kicking
they
ass.
Came out and taken names. And but there's a, but they're the it's such an earnest, like they're out to get the hippies kind of movies. I just no, I mean they're really people. Everybody I knew when I was younger like went to see them over and over
oh,
and
yeah.
over again.
As
they're
I
massive,
did, yes.
they're massive
yes,
hits.
Yes, yes.
I would. And they came out in a big box set a couple of years ago. And
right.
I keep. I well, probably like you, I keep thinking, I really should see them again.
Well,
I really should see them again
I did.
To see what I think about them.
I
really,
did. I broke down a few years ago. And
really,
yes.
and what was your impression?
I loved that a lot of them. It was like
really, even when Billy Jack went to Washington and everything. You,
well, that one was one they never released because it was
right.
such a flop. They couldn't even bear to release it, and
right.
that one's pretty bad. That one's pretty bad.
But the first one is as good
the
as I remembered, right?
The first one is it's a classic. which is that Dean Johnson of...
Oh, yes, he died.
Dean and the Weenies died under mysterious circumstances this week. And, you know, he was one of the legends of the Lower East Side and of gay culture in New York generally. And there's going to be a memorial for him on... Oh, wait a minute. Did I forget to write down the day? I think it's probably tomorrow at Rapture Books at 8 p.m. on Avenue A between 12th and 13th. Let me look it up really quick just to make sure. Anyway, yeah, the first Billy Jack movie was...
awesome.
It was absolutely awesome. The second one, they were getting a little bit too carried away. It wasn't quite as...
Wait, he took off his shoes. He'll kill you with his feet. He'll kill you with his feet. Did you see The Born Losers?
I never did, actually. I never did see The Born Losers.
That's on TV all the time. That for some reason, they have that on the Action Channel all the time, and they never have the first Billy Jack, but they have The Born Losers a lot.
Oh, yeah?
They just showed it, I think, on Turner.
Unfortunately, that was not part of the box set that I got.
Well, it's not. It's the first appearance of the character, but it's not really one of the Billy Jack movies.
Right.
It's the first... Yeah, you know, Rob Zombie on Turner Classic Movies does this thing on Friday nights called Turner Underground, and that's where he plays all the exploitation movies. Like, they had Spider Baby last Friday night, and they had Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, and they had The Born Losers. I think they're doing The Born Losers this coming Friday.
Mm. So, oh, yeah?
Because I think they have yet another DVD coming out.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, maybe I'll make an effort to check it out, except I don't have a television.
No, it's really... I love the Billy Jack movies because it's this sort of, like... The kind of where, like, biker, blue-collar culture meets hippie culture.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It was a very real important thing that had to do with the Vietnam War,
right,
you know.
Definitely.
And was really, really important in terms of, like, hippie culture actually making it into, like, everyday people's lives.
Right.
And that's really what I love about the Billy Jack movies. And
for
about a
brief moment in the 70s, before that whole ethos was sort of taken over by the radical right.
Right.
You know, the outlaw, but still,
I still believe that there is that part of it that is there. But I mean, that, and the Billy Jack movies are, yeah, they're a great example of it. You know?
Yes, the memorial for Dean Johnson of Dean and the Weenies fame is going to be tomorrow, 8 p.m., Rapture Books, Avenue A between 12th and 13th Streets. So maybe see you there. So, all right, so I found my announcement, and now
great.
We have to be off the air in just another 30 seconds.
Okay.
So, well, gee, you know, I've sort of been on the fence as to whether or not I was going to shell out my $10 to see 3:10 to Yuma.
No.
And I guess I sort of still am on the fence, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've decided against Jesse James, definitely not, because I don't like Jesse James. I don't like Brad Pitt. But I sort of still am on the fence, because hearing that, you know, it's got an implausible and disappointing ending sort of
But the
puts
scenes
me
up
off.
Until that point are so good. The acting is wonderful. I mean, I don't know that it's worth you paying the money to see it in the theater. I think you might enjoy it just as much on the DVD. So, but you should see it. Definitely should see it. If you can't afford to see it, then, you know, in the theater, then fine. But you definitely should see it. It's worth seeing.
Okay, and with that, it's 1:30 in the a.m. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with Anne-Marie Hendrickson and Bill Weinberg on WBAI 99.5 FM. And now we have to stay tuned for
Weaponry
with Tom Whisker and Bob Santucci coming up next. Should we go for another little baseball song here?
Number one.
Okay, let's do that. See you next week, and Salam Aleichem.
Well, Costello, I'm going to New York with you. You know, Bucky Harris, the Yanks manager, gave me a job as coach for as long as you're on the team.
Look, Abbott, if you're the coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
Well, you know, I never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names, but you know, strange it may seem, they give these ballplayers nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Strange names, pet names, like Dizzy Dean and...
His brother Daffy.
Daffy Dean.
And their French cousin.
French?
Gouffet.
Gouffet Dean, oh, I see. Well, let's see, we have on the...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.